Welcome to Pacific Mammal Research's Marine Mammal Highlight Series. We are a 501c3 research and education nonprofit studying marine mammals in the Salish Sea off Washington State. In this series, you will learn about different marine mammals as we discuss interesting facts about each species. This is our way to geek out, share some information, and have some fun. We hope you enjoy the series, and be sure to follow us on Instagram to vote for which animal we talk about next. And without further ado,
welcome to the Pac-Man Podcast. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Kat.
And this week is a marine mammal highlight. And this was an exciting race between the shepherd's beak whale and the, I don't know how to say the other one. Do you?
Give it a shot.
I don't even have it in front of me. Stengers?
Oh, I think it's the Stengers.
Stengers. Okay. That was close.
Something.
The Stengers beak whale. And it was a dead heat, 50-50. Percent votes for each. So what that means is that you get to choose. So we flipped a coin. Actually, I just told Kat, you choose. So Kat chose the shepherd's beak whale. And so we are running out of animals to do. We've been doing this for a while. So we're getting closer to the end of who we have choices for. And many of these are going to be shorter episodes because we don't know as much about these animals, particularly for beaked whales. But wanted to give a heads up to everybody that we will be putting out some questions of what you would like to hear, because once we run out of animals to talk about, we'll need something else to talk about. So we want to hear from you about what you want to listen to or what, you know, topics you want us to discuss and things like that. So you can help us out by help us figure out what you want to listen to and what we can talk about after we finish up these marine mammal highlights. So keep an eye out for that.
If you have any suggestions right now and you want to leave that in a comment, you can do that on our social media at Pacific Mammal Research, or I believe now on directly on this podcast episode, via Spotify. So if you guys have things that you would like us to talk about, feel free to throw that out now if they're at the top of your mind as you listen to this episode, and let us know and we'll definitely put those in a list and we'll figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah. And if some of those seem more, needs to be done in a timely manner, we can skip a marine mammal highlight and do that one instead, or even a journal review. So let us know what you guys are thinking and wanting to know about. So moving on for the shepherd's beaked whale. Again, we have beaked whales are very cool, very elusive. And where they live is hard to get to, as we'll be talking about. So there's a lot of good reasons why we know lot of nothing about these animals, but I did find some juicy little tidbits, so there is some, and these guys look really cool. So Kat is going to talk about what we know about what they look like and their distribution.
Yes, so I'm going to start off firstly by kind of qualifying a couple things, because we don't know a lot about the shepherd's beaked whale, and a lot of what we do know is based on stranded or dead animals, especially when it comes to the appearance. So
that was a good point. I was gonna bring that up too, because I meant to qualify to be like, take all this with a grain of salt to some degree, of that this is what we know on the outer edge of things. Like, we don't know a whole lot of detail, so that's a good point to remember.
Right. So the reason I wanted to say that is because I have a little bit of backstory for you first before I get into the appearance. So the species itself was actually, it's a relatively newly described species. So it wasn't described until 1937. Ooh, and that was actually, and that was actually from a complete skeleton, which was collected by none other than a Mr. G. Shepherd, hence the name.
Uh-huh.
And he was a curator at a museum in New Zealand. And so the species was actually described based on the skeleton. Originally, the external appearance of what they looked like was actually only described in detail in 2006.
Oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
which is wild. Like, that's so recently. So again, we do have some better understanding of what they look like now, and there have been a lot more reports of like stranded animals. So I just wanted to say that this is a very newly described species. And a lot of what the appearance is coming from and based on is stranded animals. And so I do just want to say that there are some things that happen to animals when they strand that might influence their physical appearance a little bit in terms of things like pigmentation coloring. But these also, this seems to be the general consensus that we're going to get into right now. So
yeah, the just as a reference to that for the coloration, and this is fish, but mahi-mahi, when they're beautiful color in the water, as soon as you take them out of the water and they die, the color changes drastically. And that's, you know, different for fish, but it's a good, you know, kind of reference of like, yeah, when the animals die, that stuff kind of changes. And so it can not be the best example of what they look like in the wild, depending on species.
Yeah. So let me get into what we think they look like. And we'll talk about all of this in a little more detail in just a second. So they are one of the largest species of beaked whales. So they reach lengths of up to 6 to 7 meters. The males are slightly bigger than the females. So typically for males, they're getting up to that like 6 to 7 meters, which is, I think, the max that they recorded was about 23 feet, which was a male, which was 7.1 meters, and about 6.5 meters or 21 feet for females. So pretty big whales. They can weigh about 2 to 3 tons. They are, in terms of coloration, they are very cool looking. So they are dark brownish on the upper surface and pale on the sides and belly area, which is fairly common for a lot of cetacean species. The pale area, which is again on that kind of belly area, also extends onto the sides and in front of their flippers. So they almost have like a look like they're kind of wearing armbands a little bit. The lighter patch above the flipper is surrounded by a dark shoulder band on the front and the darker flanks behind them. So again, that kind of darker upper surface. They also have a light patch on their melon, which is basically the forehead area. And so they are really cute. They remind me kind of little monks, where they have like the little shaved area on their head because it's lighter. It's lighter on that top part of the melon.
Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah.
It's really cute looking.
Now I'm looking at them and now I just see a little monk. Yep.
Right. There you go. You're welcome. They do have a fairly prominent beak or rostrum with a slender and straight mouth. And they do have throat grooves, which I think is really interesting. A lot of beaked whales do. And it's interesting because mostly we think about throat grooves when we're talking about baleen whales that, you know, take in huge gulps of water and then filter the fish through. So very interesting that they also have these throat grooves in a lot of beaked whale species.
Mm-hmm.
The shepherd's beaked whale is the only species of beaked whale in both the upper and lower jaws, and that's for both sexes. So there are, see, and this is the thing, we have this like really fine scale stuff because of these strandings and skeletal remains.
Like we can count all the teeth and all the things.
Right. So it's like, it's weird with it. We have like some really nitty gritty detail, but in terms of generalizations, it's a little more vague. But there are typically between 17 to 21 teeth in the upper jaw and 17 to 28 teeth in the lower jaw. There you go.
Very atypical of beaked whales, which we'll talk about in the diet, but yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I'm excited to hear how this does relate to diet. The adult males also do have a larger pair of teeth near the tip of the lower jaw that erupts over time. If you're not watching on YouTube, Cindy's doing a really fun little face imitating these little like teeth erupting. So the females actually have those too. They just don't erupt, but they are present in the actual jawbone of the female also. So pretty cool looking animals. In terms of where they are found, they are a southern hemisphere species. Typically they're found in deep, cool offshore waters between 30 to 50 degrees south. I believe from everything I could find, the most northern sighting that we have was from Shark Bay in Western Australia in 2008.
Yeah, well, now you got rid of one of my new research things.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. That's related to the distribution. So that's what we think is kind of the northernmost part of their range, as far as we know. Again, this is a very elusive species. We have not seen them very often, as I'll get to in just a second. Like I said at the top, most of these are described from stranded animals, and most of these strandings do occur around New Zealand.
Yep.
However, other ones have been found in Western Australia, South Australia, South America, and South Africa. So as of 2006, 42 stranding events have been recorded in these different regions. That's basically the number of sightings we've had of these animals. I believe there have been like 4 confirmed sightings at sea, these 42 strandings. I do have Well, I don't know if you're going to talk about it, but they were observed at sea in, I believe, 2012.
Yeah, I have a couple in the new research. I have some at sea and even underwater.
Okay, cool. So I'll leave that for you. But they have been confirmed at sea, and so this is where I wanted to circle back to what they look like, and again, kind of having these caveats about that things may change with these stranded animals. They were able to identify them at sea based on this description. So it does seem like this description holds up for live animals as well. But again, it's a little tricky because so much of this is based on dead animals. It's hard to know if we're missing anything or, is this fully accurate throughout their range, et cetera.
Yeah, and I actually have some new research on exactly that pigmentation
Perfect.
variation stuff. Yeah. But I think as long as the head thing is pretty consistent, live versus dead, that's a pretty big giveaway compared to other beaked whales. It's interesting when you hear about people seeing beaked whales, like either on whale watch boats or research boats that are out. It can be really hard to tell what species they're because they are all very similar. They're all relatively shy and elusive. And so you don't get like, they're not like right next to the boat. And you can be like, oh, that's a Baird's beaked whale or that's this beaked whale. So a lot of times it's like, what do you guys think? So I think that coloration on them, on their head, on the melon is a helpful giveaway.
Yeah, and I know the sighting that was observed in 2012, that was one of the key things that they used to identify them as that particular species was that white patch on the melon. So, yeah, they're very elusive. They spend most of their time underwater, as Cindy will talk about. So it's really hard to see these guys, and a lot of the ID is done based on what we know ranges to be. So, like, what's the most likely ones to see if you're seeing a beaked whale in this particular location? What are you likely to be seeing? So, it's a little inexact to put it lightly. But again, if all you're getting is a brief roll at the surface and then they go down, you're really not going to have a lot of time to identify a species. So,
Which actually is
yeah.
interesting with these guys with their behavior, which we'll talk about in a minute. But like, it
Cool.
seems like these guys should be easier. But yeah, they are a difficult species. That whole family is just difficult in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what I have for their appearance and distribution. So I will hand it over for their behavior and diet.
All right. So I again surprisingly found a fair amount. Now most of this is from one website, but they did have a lot of like actual references with papers and stuff like that. So but all many other ones are just like, oh, almost nothing about these animals, which is not totally untrue, but there was some other interesting information. So let's start off with their teeth. So again, Kat was saying that unlike other beaked whale species, they have a whole bunch of teeth. Most beaked whales have few to none. And they're usually sucking their prey. So it's similar to like belugas where they don't have teeth because they don't need them. They don't suck them up. And narwhals too, except for the giant tusk they have. But so unlike them, unlike the other beaked whale species, these guys feed on several species of fish and crabs and cephalopods.
Oh, there you
So
go.
that's why they're thinking that they still have teeth because they still require them.
Crunchy little critters.
But they do still they use their echolocation, which we'll talk about in a minute, and they use suction to capture still. So it's I think it depends because they have the teeth, they can feed on these other things that the other beaked whales can't. And so I think they use both, right? Which is kind of handy, especially with changing conditions to be able to change what you eat. So on that, they believe, and again, I will qualify, all of this research is done on really just if all this information is from just a few studies that have been done, being able to view them or from strandings and things like that. But what from stranded individuals, the types of fish and cephalopods they have in there, they believe that they change their feeding habits by moving back and forth between the continental slopes and small geographic landforms underwater, which are called seamounts. And they're taking advantage of schooling fish.
Cool.
So, yeah, so they get to kind of just hop around and move these different places. And if they can eat squid and fish and crabs, then they just kind of get to choose whatever they're able to get, at the time. So it's a good strategy. they use echolocation to and then suction to capture. And I'll talk about their vocalizations in a minute because there's actually an interesting study on that. They eat up to 758 grams a day, and their diving is anywhere between 5 to 15 minutes long. And at the surface, they will blow in 9 to 13 second intervals. So, and how long they stay up, I was actually surprised. I always assumed or have heard from other species, like beak whales are deep divers. And I couldn't actually find any information, we probably don't know, about how deep they go. But I'm wondering, with only 5 to 15 minute long dives, it's not a super long time to be down.
Okay, so the one thing I would say about this is, if this is from observational studies, beaked whales, other beaked whale species can stay under for over an hour.
Yeah.
So the one thing I would say with these, if these are based on observational studies, are they just witnessing a surfacing bout, in which case they would be surfacing every 5 to 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Or 10 to 15 minutes and then diving for a deeper dive, because they have to do what they call these little bounce dives in order to recalibrate the oxygen in their body.
Yeah.
So it's possible that that's just their normal dive routine. However, I'm wondering if that is also potentially you're seeing part of a dive process and not actually the entire dive process. But not all beaked whale species are like epically deep divers.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, I mean, a lot of that's from like DTAG studies and things like that. So I don't think we have any of that information on these animals. I'm not sure if they've ever been tagged in the wild.
Probably not. And also because they're eating, you know, schooling fish and crabs, those are going to be usually less deep than other cephalopods. So,
mm-hmm. Right.
So it's possible that these guys just don't do it as deep because of what they eat, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. So their behavior is really interesting because there's the few sightings that they've had suggest a very social species, which I wouldn't have expected. Although I guess that's just more of a bias of like, oh, beaked whales, they're so out there and weird and they're never seen at the surface, so they're not very social. But that's a silly reason to think that. just as we think porpoises aren't, you know, people think porpoises aren't social because of how, you know, they group, but, you know, there's other evidence that they are in different ways. So what they've documented is that they will actually swim towards vessels, and one encounter was 2 hours long.
Wow.
Yeah, so it seemed very curious. And I mean, I wonder too, they can be, if they haven't really seen boats that much because of where they are, and then they also haven't been targeted for whaling. So they don't necessarily have the same kind of like, boats are weird and I don't like them,
mm-hmm, kind of thing. Right.
So, and I did actually saw on one of the postings on Facebook, I think it was a whale watch group that went out, and they had beaked whales that came like right by the boat. So it's not, it's maybe, I don't think it was this species, but some of them are curious. They have synchronized groups of 2 to 14 whales. And I do remember that, like, when they see beaked whale groups, they are kind of large.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say in terms of the sociality. Yeah. Like typically when you're seeing them in groups, which would imply that they are a social species.
Exactly. So, they usually are in tight groups within 5 body lengths. Sometimes the groups will split up, but they're still lightly packed and traveling in the same synchronized manner, so that they are still grouped together. And that goes to that idea of what is a group. You know, how do we define that for different species and what that means? But they do still, a lot of times groups are defined as traveling or doing the same behavior and, you know, at least loosely grouped together. So that does fit. They'll breach, they'll lobtail, they'll spy hop. So they basically do the lobtailing is the cartwheeling where they have the tail and they slap it across the water. That would be super cool to see a beaked whale breach. So they do seem to be, you know, curious, and more social behaviors than we are used to seeing with some of these far out deep whale species. They do use tactile stuff for socialization, for care, for young, and for mating. I'll talk about mating in a minute, but we don't know too much about that. Their vocalization, though, that they, and this again kind of goes to the sociality, they have two different types that they've documented. So there's foraging and catching prey. And this one study had broadband echolocation at around 19.2 kilohertz. But then there was, I did see another one. I think I'm going to talk about it in the, I couldn't find that one. There was another one that said that they have their echolocation is above human hearing. So I think there's some, we're not sure exactly where their echolocation stands, but that one study that said 19.2 kilohertz was on the median, they did have limited bandwidth to record, so they may not be catching all of the vocalizations. So it could be higher.
Gotcha.
So they do their echolocation, kind of normal standard, and then they also have burst pulse clicks. And this was from a Linusian et al. At 2018, and from New Zealand. And they recorded those vocalizations, and they were thought to be used for socialization or in prey capture. And we've discussed burst pulses before in some of the other podcasts. Burst pulses are a weird, like, echolocation click and whistle smash together into this weird form. And because of that, it makes it really hard for us to try to figure out what those are. So burst pulse vocalizations, as far as I remember or know from vocalization studies, are the hardest to study. And we don't know what to do with them, really.
Yeah, they're a little, like you said, I think that's a good word. They're kind of messy to try to tease apart what the function of them is, especially if you're not able to physically observe what the animal's doing or how their conspecifics are behaving at the same time. Like if this is a tag study, it's really tricky to know like at what point and why were they using this particular thing.
Yeah, and even with the dolphins in the Bahamas, like we're watching them as they do their vocalizations, and we still don't know exactly what those burst pulses are doing. Yeah. So it can be really hard, but they do have those. So again, goes that sociality. A lot of times we do associate burst pulses and things in social contexts and things like that. So in other studies, so likely that they do have that social nature. They may have their own distinct vocalization based on low FM, which I'm assuming meant frequently modulated. They used an acronym, but didn't actually explain that anywhere else.
I would assume that's probably what that is.
Yeah. So they found based on low frequency modulated near the water surface at 100 to 300 meters, but there was no data on these vocalizations in deeper water. So
weird.
Yeah. They could have their own special thing.
Cool.
Know about. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. They're pretty awesome. For reproduction, basically little is known outside of this one paper by New et al. 2013. This is where basically all this information comes from. And so I will preface this too for the new research. There's probably fewer new research than I would have on other ones because a lot of it's in here in this data, right? We're just learning about these species behavior and stuff. So there's not a lot of newer things happening. Thought to be polyandrous because females are often seen traveling with multiple males. So they get to mate a lot. They are seen in the upwelling. They're seen more during the upwelling season between November to May. And that's thought to be their mating season as well. They have one calf per breeding season and likely every 2 to 3 years. Again, all this stuff is really vaguely estimated.
I'm not speculative quite, but like kind of close to being speculative probably.
Exactly. Yeah. It's based on some data, but not enough to be like, this is it. Mm-hmm. Gestation is estimated to be a year. When born, the calves can be up to 46% of the mom's length.
Ouch. Which
is, yeah, I know. Right? That's exactly what I thought. I was like, that's like
works the same way for beaked whales, but that does not sound comfortable.
Because so normally if we were talking about calves, the definition of a calf is usually less than a third of the body length of an adult, like a new calf. So the fact that this one's almost half the mom's length when it comes out, like that's just, it seems uncomfortable during the entire pregnancy and also the birth.
Ah, wow.
Weaning is thought to be after a year, but sometimes can be longer. There was one larger animal that was seen with a presumed mother suggesting extended time. And we saw that in the Bahamas. We had that one spotted female that was still with her mom at like age 8, and she should have left at like age 3 or 4. so, you know, that could be a normal thing. It could be just the one weird one that they found, you know, but we just don't have enough data to say what that is. Sexually mature from the limited research again is 6.6 meters for females and 7.0 for males, which kind of goes with the sizes you were saying before, that they become sexually mature at that adult stage. And it's suggested that survival is the main priority for adult females if they have to support a calf past weaning, which, I mean, I'm not really sure why that was specific to beaked whales, but
I was going to say that seems like that goes without saying for most animals, but
right?
I mean,
But,
okay.
maybe particularly for these guys, I don't know. The reason why they were saying that is that the females may delay the implantation of another fetus, right? They basically won't have another calf if it takes so long to keep those one animal alive, they're gonna put their eggs in that basket rather than having that one die and trying another fetus, which they could die. Mm-hmm. So if food sources are low and can't support gestation, they will terminate gestation or lactation to store more energy to ensure a successful reproduction in the future. And so I totally get the terminate gestation because the baby hasn't been born yet, but I thought it was very interesting that they would stop lactation with a calf that's already been born. But if you are trying to survive yourself to be able to have more babies down the line, then losing that one, that maybe would be the equation to do. Lose the one to
yeah.
be able to later.
And I mean, that does happen for various other mammalian species too, when they're malnourished. So if the female
right.
is malnourished, the milk dries up. Like that's very common in terrestrial species as well. So maybe it's just a variation on that, where it's like, if the female's at that state of not doing well physically, this is something that just kicks in as like a self-preservation. Yeah.
Well, and we've talked about that with other species too. So when they did, I thought it was interesting that they had this like pointed out, and I was like, well, this just seems like that's like kind of a standard mammalian thing. Like if your body can't do reproduction, it's not going to do it. It's going to stop forever. Mm-hmm. So I just don't know. I don't know if it, I'm not sure why it was kind of highlighted, but there you go.
Right.
Makes sense. And maybe it's just more, it's harder for them out there in the deep water, you know, whatever they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to talk about lifespan later?
Nope. Go ahead.
Okay. So the lifespan, again, they don't know, is 27 to 39 for all of the Ziphidae family, which is a family of beaked whales. The stranded individuals that they've had are aged 12 to 15 on average, with one that was 23, but is presumed that they can live longer. A Baird's beaked whale was estimated to be 84 by tooth layers that they have now. Oh. So, we really don't know how long they live, but probably 30, 40 or more years is likely. So that's what I had for their behavior. So we will take and their diet. We'll take a quick break and get back with the threats and the new research. We'll be right back. Hello, listeners. This is Cindy, the research director at Pacific Mammal Research, and I wanted to take just a minute to thank you for listening and supporting our work. And I wanted to see maybe if you wanted to learn a little bit more about the background of what we do and what we see in the field and other kind of cool information that you can get by subscribing to the podcast for only $5 a month. You can get ad-free episodes as well as these mini episodes where we discuss the things we've seen in the field, the stuff we've gone to with workshops, and other little interesting tidbits of information for our subscribers only. This is a great way to help support PacMam, who we are a very small nonprofit, so every dollar helps us continue the work that we do and provide the information and the fun podcast that we have that hopefully you guys are enjoying. So if you can, think about it, subscribe to the podcast, and help support our work, and we hope you enjoy. All right, we're back. So tell us about the threats for the animals that we know barely anything about.
So I have to say, this is one of the less depressing ones that I get to do. Yeah. So in terms of status, as you might imagine, we basically know nothing. So they are listed as data deficient by the IUCN, and we really have no idea what the overall general population of these guys is, because we don't see them enough to really have any idea.
You've only seen them like in 2006.
Right, exactly. So it's like, we didn't even really know that you existed beyond a skeleton until 2006. So there's that. Again, we know that they do strand, right? So in terms of the threats, we know that they are like many other beaked whale species, that they might be prone to stranding. Again, we've talked about stranding at length in other episodes, so I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on it here, because we don't really know what the propensity is for these guys. Again, there have been 42 of these strandings recorded. You'd think if they strand a lot or very, very frequently, that might actually be higher even. So They are prone to stranding to some degree, like a lot of other beaked whales. Noise pollution is thought to be a threat, again, because they have these vocalizations as a social species, and especially if they are foraging in this area. They are more prone to noise pollution from things like sonar, from seismic activity, from increasing vessel traffic, even especially if they are spending more of the time at that upper surface level.
When I think of threats for beaked whales, the Navy sonar testing is the biggest one that I think of, because a lot of the strandings that have happened from those are beaked whales because of where they do the testing and where the beaked whales are. So a lot of times there will be large mass strandings of beaked whales from that.
And so part of the reason that that is also really important is that because the beaked whales that dive deep spend most of their life at depth, when they are startled or if they hear something and they have a flee response, that actually can be extremely dangerous to them based on how they need to actually surface in order to not get the bends. So just like other animal species like divers, you have to surface in intervals to allow the levels of nitrogen and oxygen to recalibrate in your blood. Otherwise, you can end up with these little pockets in the blood that actually can lead to death. And so that's basically what can lead to the bends. So again, that's where noise can be more of an issue. If these guys are not spending a huge amount of time at deep depths, I'm not sure that that particular knock-on effect of noise would be as much of a problem for these guys, because if they're not going to those, you know, hundreds of meters deep, then it's not that's going to be issue. Quite as detrimental potentially, but it, just in terms of disturbance and you know, potential knock-on impacts to their life history, noise can still be a problem. And again, they live in a relatively non-trafficked part of the world. However, with global transport massively increasing everywhere around the world, that's likely to become more of a problem, right? So this is something we're sort of watching. The other one I have here, which I thought was really disturbing, was plastic pollution. So they have been, the stranded shepherd's beaked whales have been found with plastic in their stomachs.
Mm-hmm.
And these are rare and elusive whales. And these are still
remote
in remote areas. And these are still being impacted by our waste. So just another... I'm sure anyone listening to this podcast is not throwing plastic litter around anyway, but just another reminder to share with your friends and family that our waste and the way that we dispose of our waste has a massive global impact.
Yep.
And I think it's sometimes having this type of example where this is a really rare and very, very rarely seen animal.
Yeah,
and they're still having plastic in their stomach. Right. Why? So, I mean, like that's, if we can impact them there, not good.
Yeah.
So those are really the main things. Again, we don't know enough about these guys to know if they are prey for things like killer whales or sharks, which would also be found in this area. Several other beaked whale species are potential prey for killer whales. So it's possible that these guys might be on the menu as well, but there's not really any data to support that one way or the other at this moment. So that's all I had for the threats and the status, which, like I said, is kind of nice to not have to be talking about what's going to kill them for 15 minutes. I do have the only other, I'll just throw this in here because it's not pretty, it's more just like a general note. So they are called the shepherd's beaked whale, obviously, after the gentleman who found them, but they're also known
that.
As the, they're also known as the Tasman whale or the Tasmanian whale because of where they are located.
Cool. I think they should be called the Tasmanian devil whale. That would be fun.
There we go. What was your question? Sorry.
I've been thinking about this the entire time. I'm like, where was the skeleton from? Was it just a stranded animal, or like, how did they get a full skeleton in the species?
I'm presuming he found it on the beach. It said it was a nearly complete skeleton. And he was Mr. Shepherd was a curator at the Whanganui Alexander Museum in New Zealand. And so he obviously knew what he was looking at. He presumably knew a lot of people who could come take a look at it and determine that it was something different. I would assume this is something that he just found washed up on the beach, I would guess.
It's just crazy. I mean, the unlikeliness of happening upon it in the first place at the right time, as to where it didn't have any flesh on it yet, so you couldn't tell exactly what it was, but none of the bones had been moved. Like, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming this was probably like, I guess when I was reading that story in my head, I just kind of envisioned this beach that not a lot of people frequent. And you just see this thing over there, you go check it out. And probably other people had walked past it and just, oh, that's a whale, that's a dolphin or something. And
Right. But
being a curator of a museum, he probably had just like, wait a minute, that looks different than anything we have seen before.
even just the fact that scavenging animals, because when things start ripping it's gonna get bones are gonna get taken away. The water tide, like where was it on the beach
Yeah.
that the water didn't take it
Great
away? Like
question.
so many,
If
I
you're
mean, so many
ever
questions.
in New Zealand, the skeleton of the whale is on display in the Whanganui Regional Museum, so you can go check it out and probably learn the full story if you're in
Oh
New
my.
Zealand,
Definitely does.
FYI.
Eventually, we'll be going to New Zealand someday. So, I mean, I think I will, but we'll see. That's what I want to do. Very cool, though. Very cool. Okay. So, like I said, some of the new research is really incorporated into what I already talked about because a lot of this is relatively new that we are looking at. But I have a couple interesting stories. So, I'll start off with the one that Kat already talked about is that. Jared Towers, who actually is a researcher up here in the Salish Sea in Canada, but he goes all over the world to do stuff. And so there was a paper that oh, this is actually not that one. Just kidding. But
I was
this
going
is
to
a
say the one
different.
I was referencing was in Australia, so that's definitely not the
No,
same
that
one
no,
unless
I
he was
did.
down there.
I did. No, that's sorry. That was the Holyoke at 2014. So that whale was the northernmost sighting in Shark Bay. And it was estimated at 12 to 15 years old based on tooth dentition. And it was a female and it was in Shark Bay, which is crazy. Because so just to get the difference in, because I have a hard time thinking about like how far north that is from where they're normally at. So their distribution is between 33 and 50 degrees, and Western Shark Bay is at 113 degrees. So that's quite a ways out of where they normally are seen. So it would be interesting to know, like, is that just one weirdo that went on a walkabout, you know, or that they are more like it, or they're spreading that way, you know? We don't know. The next one, the towers, was interesting because it said 20, I think this was a 2022. I forgot to write the date on my piece of paper here. But it was, yes, this was 2022. So they had is the a sighting in the Indian Ocean, which was confirming their circumpolar distribution. So I guess it wasn't like it's assumed or whatever, but that sighting really confirmed that this is a circumpolar all the way around, a thing. And it was a short note, so they didn't have like an abstract or anything like that. But so just confirmed that again. So we've only confirmed just now in 2022 that they are actually circumpolar distribution in the area that we know them that they're at. Then in 2019, Thompson et al. Had the first underwater sighting off, I love this, Inaccessible Island, which
Cool.
is a cool name, at Tristan da Cunha. And these were two individuals were observed together on video footage obtained via midwater stereo-baited remote underwater video systems, or BRUVs. Yeah.
A mouthful.
Yes, that's why I copy and pasted it from
yikes.
later.
Yeah. Wow. Well done.
And so it was so first of all, interesting that that's the first time again, 2019, the first time we've seen them underwater. Like this is so new. But the observed individuals lacked the dark flipper stripe observed in previous descriptions, indicating that the species may exhibit greater variation in pigmentation than previous records indicate. And so, you know, it's likely that there is some variation between locations, you know, in their range, and also individuals. I mean, you know, certain species have ridiculous amount of individual variation in their coloration. So it'll be interesting to see what that as they hopefully get to observe more animals, what that looks like. But they may be more variable than we previously thought. And then the last one I have actually isn't. I was hoping to get more information from it. Because the title seems really great. It's Donnelly et al. At 2022, and it's new diagnostic descriptions and distribution information for shepherd's beaked whale off southern Australia and New Zealand. I couldn't access the whole paper. I could only get the abstract, but the abstract is as such. Shepherd's beaked whale of the family Ziphidae is one of the least known cetacean species in the world. To date, information on the species, distribution, behavior, and morphology have been acquired from a combination of small number of aerial observations, vessel-based at-sea sightings with no accompanying photographs, and data collected from beach cast specimens. Differences in age classes encountered and in the state of decomposition of stranded animals have led to a high variability in published accounts of the external pigmentation and consistent general descriptions of the features lacking. Thus, uncertainty remains concerning the diagnostic features of the species, particularly for identification at sea. In particular, the lack of photographic evidence from previous vessel-based sightings has precluded later scrutiny, resulting in uncertainty in how such data should be treated when, for example, describing the species distribution. But it doesn't tell me what the paper's going to tell me. Like, I'm like, that's
interesting.
So I don't know what the new diagnostic descriptions and distribution information for the beaked whale was because I couldn't access the paper, but I will have the link to it if anybody's able to or interested in looking at it. But it does sound, at least from the title, that they're describing a bit more than what we've had, what we've been talking about with the few past research and specimens that they've had. So
interesting. So yeah. Let me add one more. Is that the last one that you had?
Yep, that's the last one I had.
Okay, so let me then, because that didn't actually talk about the one that I was referencing at the beginning. So let me just briefly talk about the one from 2012. So the reason that was, I'll link to the news article in the resources in the sources section. But basically, the reason that was so important was that was the first video footage we think of Shepherd's beaked whale in the wild ever.
I didn't find that one.
It was a news article. So it was. It was from a whale watch vessel in Australia. Ooh. And again, these people have been on the, you know, these naturalists have been watching the animals for years and years and years out there, and they've never seen it. And so again, like I said, part of the way that they were able to identify these animals as the shepherd's beaked whale was based on that coloration, particularly around the head area. So that was just kind of cool because again, like this is such a new and emerging species. I mean, that was 2012 that we had the first footage possibly ever of these animals,
and important that it wasn't from a research group, right? That the power of community science and whale watching, I know there's a lot of controversy as to what should be done, but the benefits of it are things like this, where they get this information that we don't always get because researchers can't be out there.
And the whale watchers are out there consistently, which is huge.
So they're more likely to bump into the strange ones that we don't see very often, more so than others, because they're out all the time. And they can.
So anyway, just wanted to drop that in.
Yeah, that's great. It's important to remember that it's not just researchers that can contribute to science and research and understanding these species. So that's awesome.
We're all researchers to a degree.
That's right. Everybody's a scientist, just a little bit. So that's it for the Shepherd's Beaked Whale. And so we already have the next episode is our journal review, and we've already got that one picked out. It came out. We've been waiting for this paper to come out. It's been talks for years as they've been collecting the data and stuff. It's about killer whales out here. The southern resident killer whales that eat fish and things that they're doing that are weird that are not fish related and happen to involve
beef tuned.
Yes. So we'll be talking about that one next week. We're very excited to get to share that with you guys. So in the meantime, stay on our social media channels, Instagram, Facebook, visit our merch store, go to our website, and you'll be linked to our merch store that has our shirts and t-shirts and sweatshirts and cups and, mugs, not cups, mugs and bags and stuff like that. And all that money goes back to helping the research and the outreach that we do, like this podcast. So thank you all for your support, and share it with your friends, and we will talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye.
This was brought to you by Pacific Mammal Research, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To learn more about the species we discuss, check out our blog. Head to our website, www.pacmam.org, that's pacmam.org, to check it out. Also, help us continue providing fun and educational content like this by donating today. Your help is how we can continue to do our work and share it with you. Thanks.